Okay, welcome. This is the third part of the three different classes that are seminars about science in the Bible, the last two of which are archaeology and history based. Very cool stuff we've been going through for the last few weeks. Apologize for my little frog in my throat. Not 100% sure. I feel like I have allergies, but I don't have allergies. So I don't know what's going on. Anyway, this is the second part of the archaeology. And tonight, we're going to accomplish a few things, but mostly it's going to be another sort of fire hose of awesomeness about all the different discoveries and scientific things that have really just kind of proven over and over and over again how historically accurate the Bible is. People have, you know, had trouble with that idea, and slowly but surely that is becoming sort of an accepted fact. In the first class, what we did was we talked about the really most ancient and most difficult part of the whole discussion, which was Genesis 1 and the Big Bang and astrophysics and quantum dynamics and all those concepts. Including evolutionary biology, that showed us how accurate and scientific the Bible is in a very complex way. And that sort of laid the groundwork for establishing our unity between the Bible and science, which is extremely important when we start talking about all the dates and all the different digs and all the different discoveries. You sort of, if you want to talk about an archaeological discovery, you kind of have to believe in archaeology. And to do that, you kind of have to believe in science and dating and the concepts of what scientists, archaeologists, historians, climatologists, biologists, etc. do. So that brings us to tonight, where we're going to get into some really fun stuff. And the fun stuff is going to continue from last time. Now, last time we were looking at who Moses was. And this was super cool because people know the story of Moses. They know the story of the Exodus. Yes. Thank you so much. Oh my gosh, Dustin just asked me if I was recording because the first one I did not. The second one I did, this one I am. And I'm going to go back and re-record the first one, so it's going to be okay. It'll all be online. discovering who Moses was last time and talking about the pharaohs, the time frame, the exact dates was so enlightening. It showed us so much important information about that portion of the Bible. We're going to go even deeper and sort of wider in our depth of archaeology tonight. So part three, or the second part of the archaeology session, here we go. When we talk about the timing last time of the Exodus being 1446 BC, the way we arrived at that was a calculation based on the temple being built under Solomon. Now, the reason that's important is if a scientist, a historian, archaeologist, if they're arguing against the existence of Solomon or David or the temple, then we have trouble with that core date that's going to bring us to the other dates. So we're going to look at that tonight. But let's just talk about why all that battle is going on. I mean, the bottom line is it should be pretty easy with the specific dates, specific locations, all the names in the Old Testament, and there's hundreds of dates, locations, names that match historical records. It would make sense that no one would be bothering to try to claim something like the Bible is not historical or accurate, but they do. So we need to kind of talk about why they do. So let me get my slides to work here. Let's talk about this history of attacks on the Bible. It's an important thing for us to understand As you know, and as we discussed in every class, if the enemy can convince people that the Bible is wrong or doesn't accurately reflect things or contains fairy tales or lies, if they can do that, even though that's virtually impossible, but the average person doesn't really study all this stuff. They don't really know, right? So in that case, they might not be able to defend themselves against the idea that they're being attacked with, oh, well, this is obviously not real because of blah, blah, blah. Well, if you can take away the validity and the historicity of the Bible, then you can start chipping away at the fundamental theological aspects of the Bible. If a date and a king is wrong, then what about something that someone said, like a quote from Jesus? What about the rest of it? Maybe that's wrong. And eventually you can undermine the entire concept. And of course, that's the plan. If they can take away the truth of the Bible, then of course, we don't have anything to stand on, and now things start falling apart. It's interesting to note, and you can research this extensively outside of here, because we only have a few hours to cover about 20 hours of material tonight. But if you keep working outside of here, you're going to discover that there's never been a scientific discovery ever that's contradicted the Bible. People should now, when we're in the thousands of such things, people should now be paying attention to that, but they don't. They have trouble with that. And that's okay, but that's the history. So, for instance, let me go here. For example, originally it was a physical attack, right? If we can just get rid of the manuscripts and the people. This went on for hundreds of years. The idea was, well, if we kill everybody involved in Christianity, we burn everything they ever had, problem solved. You would think that was a pretty good plan, especially when you're a Roman Empire and these guys are sort of a ragtag band, but it didn't work. And that didn't work, and it got copied properly, and it got hid properly, and it went from place to place. Okay, well, let's attack the historicity of Jesus. And for a long time in the 20th century, people actually believed that that person wasn't real. The attack was, well, Jesus is just like a made-up itinerant preacher guy. It's not a real physical, historical person. And they tried that for a long time. By the time we're in the 80s and 90s, though, atheist secular scientists are just stacking up document after document proving this person was real. So then they go, okay, well, we really can't prove there was no Jesus. Obviously, there was a real Jesus. So let's attack the Bible then. Okay, if Jesus was real, but he was just a guy. I mean, even the absolute leaders of the entire atheist world, I'm talking about people like Richard Dawkins and those guys, the Four Horsemen, even those guys go, okay, Jesus was real, but all the miracles are fake. They're just working every angle they can, but every single angle fails. They tried to go with some kind of attack, like, okay, well, maybe Jesus was real, but the Bible's not, or whatever. So we need a way to figure that out. So let's just look at this, because this is going to blow your mind. This is the actual historical documentation of the actual records of Jesus. I'm going to start with six original non-Christian sources. Okay? And there they are, Tacitus, Lucian, etc. You see them on the board. Some of these guys, like Celsus, who had a library in Ephesus, hated Christians. They would do anything. But in their efforts to delete Jesus, they were talking about it. Of course, we have Christian authors. You cannot know their, you know their names, you know, John and Paul and Matthew and Peter. All those guys wrote things. We got a collection of them, right? I think it would be very inappropriate, as well as scientifically inaccurate, to just count those guys out. A historical linguist can tell the difference between those writers. This is not one guy writing a bunch of made-up stuff. They can tell the difference in the writing styles, the difference in the writing. That's why Hebrews stands out, because we can't figure out the writer. And the reason we can't figure out the writer of Hebrews is because it doesn't match linguistically exactly Paul or John or Peter. I'm going to put a vote in for either Timothy or Barnabas, but we don't know. We don't know. We don't have anything to compare with. But you've got all those Christian authors, okay? Then immediately thereafter, I'm talking about within a few years, immediately thereafter, all these people are writing about those people and about Jesus. We're talking about immediately thereafter. Ignatius and Polycarp are alive when John is still alive. Clement, they call him the first pope. He's the bishop of Rome. Irenaeus and the whole list here are early first couple century AD specific writers about Jesus. Now, let's just compare, shall we? Because I don't think any secular historian is going to deny the existence of Julius Caesar. Like, everybody knows Julius Caesar was real. One of the founding emperors of the world, you know, the great Roman Caesar, Julius Caesar. Side note, chef side note, Caesar's house is not named after him. Okay, whole different story. He saves our Cardini, Mexican. Anyway, see me afterwards for more notes on Caesar's salad. But Julius Caesar, there's accounts of the Gallic Wars. There's Cicero, Sallust, Seneca, and Plutarch. There's five historical references that are contemporary that give us knowledge of Julius Caesar. Five. Okay, how about Alexander the Great? Arrian writes about it. Plutarch, Aelian. There's 10. This is the ruler of the entire world. Both of these guys. There's 5 and 10 records that we can go look at and study to see if we believe Alexander the Great was real. We can go study these 10 people. If we want to see, if we believe Julius Caesar was real, we've got 5. And then Socrates, the foundation of all argument, of all discussion, of Socratic arguments, the foundation of all our university systems. Plato, of course, talks about him, but 6 people. 5, 10, 6. 3 of the most famous people of the BC, you know, era. Those are the records. No one doubts their existence. And this is what you need to know. There's a minimum of 25 confirmed historical records, only half of which are Christians. This is all those guys combined together. If you don't believe in the real Jesus living, you don't believe in Julius Caesar, Alexander the Great, Socrates, or anyone else ever. We barely have that many on Shakespeare, and that's only 400 years ago. That's how big a deal this is. So that argument is over. But, and even the atheist leaders admit that argument's over, by the way. They went on record recently. Okay, we give up. Jesus is real. Let's move on to the fact that none of this stuff is. Okay, good luck. Now, the core of the argument that we're going to look at tonight concerns David and Solomon. There was a kingdom called the Kingdom of Israel. It existed. It was famous. It was a big deal. However, there hasn't been historically very much proof besides the Bible. And here's why. Has anybody ever been to Jerusalem or know anything about Jerusalem? So you could just start digging anywhere, archaeological problem, no, you can't touch Jerusalem. There's three giant religions, all of which have councils, all of which have authority, quarters. There's a complete moratorium on any archaeological studies inside Jerusalem. And Jerusalem is where it all happened. If everybody left Jerusalem, if every single person left Jerusalem and 100 archaeologists with their teams descended on Jerusalem, we would have everything ever, possibly the Ark. But we would have everything we ever needed to have ever, because we would just dig up Jerusalem and find it all. But we can't. You can't dig in Jerusalem. You can barely go down in the sewers and look around with a flashlight. I mean, it is really, really hard to get anything done. And of course, that's where David and Solomon lived. They built it. The mound that's so protected by the world that you cannot touch is the Temple Mount of Solomon. It's what they did. It's where they lived. So, of course, there's very little evidence of this empire. Of course, there's very little evidence of David and Solomon. But without evidence of David and Solomon, or Israel as a country, Israel as a kingdom, then we would have a hard time putting our dates together that get us to Moses, right? So let's talk about what this looks like, because we need to look into the historicity of David and Solomon. If you could break down David and Solomon, you can break down everything else. If Jesus is a better David, or the son of David, or this is the city of David, if you can get rid of David, then that's all gone, right? Right? This is the perfect thing to attack. You can't do anything. You can't dig where it matters. So you can attack it all day because you can't do anything about it. But the proof of David and Solomon, regardless of the moratorium and the master work of the enemy at securing that knowledge far away from human eyes, even with all of that, it continues to grow. So let's just take a look at how this works. We need to track our basic dates. So this chart I'm about to give you is pretty important, because it just summarizes everything we've done in the whole class tonight, last time. It's the dates. Jacob and Joseph enter Egypt in 1876. Now, this is all plus or minus a year or two. Obviously, we're talking about 4,000 years ago. Okay. But that's the approximate date. Moses and Joshua leave Egypt, 1446. That's biblically confirmed and archaeologically confirmed. Okay. So we've dug where those Hebrew servants, slaves that were in Egypt were supposed to be living. We've dug there, and we've dug at the right time. And we've discovered that that's true, okay? 1446 on the Exodus. 40 years in the desert, 1446 to 1406. Remember, time is going the other way. This is B.C. So it's getting lower as it gets later. Does that make sense? So 10 B.C. is after 20 B.C. Yeah, I know it's weird because we're used to 1980 being before 1990. It goes the other way on the other side. Invasion of Canaan, right around 1400, probably 1406 to be exact, but something around 1400. That's the time of the judges. Once they're in Canaan, once they've begun to conquer Canaan and set up the kingdoms and the tribes of Israel in Canaan, and I already told you last time that archaeologically we've discovered a massive decrease in local Canaanite populations during the period of time of the, you know, early part of that century. So when this happened between 1400 and 1370, there's a downward trend in the population of the Canaanite people. because they're being conquered. This date here is your judges' time. So we're talking about Deborah and Gideon and Samson getting his hair cut and all that. That's the time of the judges. The way the time of judges worked is there wasn't a kingdom. It was like loosely confederized, sort of organized many kingdoms with different families, different tribes of Israel. And they would turn their back on God and they would get invaded and that's what would happen. And they would turn back to God and he would send some kind of rescuer to them. And that person was called a judge. People like Samson, right? 1050 is when Saul became king because the people cried out for a king. We're surrounded by kingdoms. We need a king. Saul was really popular, good looking, kind of tall, probably had wavy blonde hair. I'm just kidding. Probably didn't have blonde hair, but he looked like, you know, The Rock or, you know, Jason Momoa. So everybody was like, wow, Saul's the man. And he's super sexy, so let's make him the king. Now, but he didn't really cut it. So we're going to get to somebody who was a man after God's own heart. And when God wins your battles for you, you don't need sexy girls on here. So David becomes king around 1010. And that's when we had the real sort of power, first king, the real establishment of the empire, the real establishment of the kingdom of Israel. Solomon follows him, 970. Very important dates. So we've got all this. Then Solomon messes everything up. Now, this is very ironic, and we'll have to save it for another class. But Solomon's the wisest man and the richest man on the planet. He's basically the coolest guy ever. But he has a problem. All human beings have problems. Nobody's perfect. You might be the smartest guy ever. But a lot of times, if you're the richest and smartest guy on the planet, you have real trouble with relationships. I'm reminded of somebody alive right now who maybe not quite as wise as Solomon, but probably even richer. And he has a real problem with relationships. Solomon had a ton, an absolute ton of wives, and they were from a lot of countries, and they were bringing in a whole lot of idol worship and a whole lot of other stuff. And he was just kind of letting them do what they wanted because he liked the ladies, okay? And it's going to break the kingdom apart. When he dies, there's going to be a civil war, and the kingdom's going to break apart. And in 930 BC, so you see this history. So we need to focus on the core of this, which really starts at the time of Judges, but finishes after the kingdom divides. So our focus for tonight is about 1200 to 800 BC. We're going to go step by step through every one of those years. We'll be here, but I'll have you out before dawn. I think that are you going to make breakfast for everybody at 7? Thank you so much. No, I'm just kidding. We got to hurry because there's a whole bunch of stuff. Let's just start with this, like, blow your face off slide right here. We need to talk about those guys. Okay, you guys know that's a country called Syria today in the world. And you know they have a capital named Damascus. This is the origin of all of that. That's a kingdom called Aram-Damascus. It's a combo. You sometimes see it as Aram, Arameans. You sometimes see it as Damascus. And you see the proximity of Aram-Damascus to Israel. So now, the kingdom of Judah, which is in purple here, okay, kind of a hot pink, and the blue kingdom of Israel, that's when the kingdom, after Solomon died, split in half. Now you notice that we've got a red section, and remember, Ascalon and other cities, that's the Philistines. Then you've got Ammon here, you've got Moab. Remember Moab, the kingdom of Edom, the Edomites. And there's Aram-Damascus. Now, Aram-Damascus is a big deal because not only is it kind of historically famous, but it's in between Israel and the Assyrians. The Assyrians are going to come later and take over. They're eventually going to take away not only Aram Damascus, but the kingdom of Israel. The northern kingdom is going to fall, and everybody's going to be taken away by the Assyrians. But this place, Aram Damascus, is in between the two. Now, you'll notice the dates 1100 to 732. If you go and read, say, Isaiah, you'll find that the 700s, like 732, these are the times that the northern kingdom falls to Assyria. And the reason I'm telling you all this crazy archaeological and historical stuff is because we're going to have a triple reference. So if you have a reference to something that's in the Bible only, then people will say, oh, well, you have to have faith to believe that. But if there's something in the Bible and another kingdom wrote about it, writes something about it, that's a double reference. In this case, we have a triple reference. Now, the reason that's important is because David and Solomon both fight Aram Damascus. I've got references if you have your Bible with you, you want to look it up. But in 1 Kings, it talks about the king of Aram Damascus. That's Hezron. So Hezron and Rezon are the same guy. So for instance, in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, my master's name was Hani Sales. Ronnie was the spelling, R-O-N-E-Y, pronounced Hani. H and R get flipped in many, many languages worldwide because they're similar pronunciations. You know how some people have a little trouble, like some Asian cultures have a little trouble with L's, right? There's linguistic things. So if they were trying to say something, they might confuse an L and an R. It happens all the time historically. So pronunciation and spelling, which has now come down through Greek and through Hebrew into English, might have an H, might have an R, might have an I, might be Hezion. Don't forget that there aren't any vowels in ancient Hebrew. So it could be Hezon or Hezion. Now, I mention that because it's in a bunch of different references from a bunch of different countries. So his son, his grandson is named Ben-Hadad. And he fights King Asa in the early 9th century. This is just a reference to the king list of Aram Damascus being cross-referenced with the Bible and the records of Assyria. So the Assyrian Empire has records. The archaeology happening in Aram Damascus has records. And the Bible and the people of Israel have records. And these are triple confirmed references. Now, I want you to look at this word for a second because it's a crazy word, but it's a really cool word. This is the plural of stela. Now, I've been trying to find out the proper pronunciation of this word for a decade. Every single person pronounces it differently. Some people say steel when they have S-T-E-L-E. Some people say stela, stele. Some people even call it stella. I think they probably read too much Streetcar Named Desire, but stele, what they are is a stone record. So what happened is an ancient king would not only want to make a record of their conquest and their victories and their heroism, but they would want to make it in stone. And then they would want to make copies and post it up. It's sort of like a warning sign on the edge of the kingdom, on the main highway coming in Aram Damascus or wherever it says, this is who we've killed. This is all the people we've taken out. You probably want to rethink your plan, right? It's just the story. Sometimes it's on a tomb. Sometimes it's on a castle or like some kind of leader's home. Sometimes it's in public squares. But it's a declaration of the greatness of this person. This is what they look like. Now, just look at that. Now, that's the Renefta Stele. Now, that's all words, okay? So you can see that that thing contains a sort of insane amount of information. But that's a giant stone tablet erected in the honor of Merneptah, telling about his exploits. This is in Egypt, okay? This was created in 1208 BC by the Egyptian pharaoh Merneptah. Those are his dates, 1213 and 1230. It was discovered in 1896 AD, right, by archaeologists. Its current location is the Cairo Museum. You can go to Cairo and read it for yourself. Well, you're probably going to need to know that language, but you know what I mean. It's right there to see for everyone to study in the Cairo Museum. Merneptah was the son of Ramses the Great, Ramses II, who was the greatest pharaoh of all, basically. A couple hundred years after the story last time, right? The story last time was the story of Moses, several hundred years before Ramses the Great. This is his son. And this is what it says. Hieroglyphs in line 27 say the word Israel. He's conquering, he's fighting, he's whooping butt all over the world. He's Merneptah. Here's my stele. And one of the places he beats down is Israel. Now, this is one of the times in the time of Judges when they're invaded by foreign kings and beat down, and they're going to come back. But it says Israel in an Egyptian writing in 1208. That's the earliest mention of Israel outside of the Bible, obviously. That's the earliest mention of Israel ever. It's in Egypt. So obviously that's a pretty big deal. This is the first evidence ever of the word Israel in a non-biblical source. Now, this is another one. This is the Kirk monoliths. There's several of them. They're gigantic. You know, they're all about the kings and how cool they are. Now, these are from 879 to 852, two different years, two Assyrian kings. You can find their names all over history and the Bible, but their names are Asherbet. Okay, Ashurnasirapal. And his son, Shalmaneser III, these were discovered in 1861. They're at the British Museum. You want to see those? It's a little bit closer. And they're dating to that 800 period, late 800s. Now, what they're saying is Shalmaneser section is talking about fighting Ahab, the king of Israel. You can find stories of Ahab in the Bible. You can find stories of him, not only that, but we've been talking about him in the Sunday classes with Elijah and Elisha, because Ahab had Jezebel, and they were trying to promote the Baal worship and all of that, and all the prophets were fighting against them. And this actually names Ahab. So you could, like, say, oh, Elijah, blah, 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 Mount Carmel, fire, blah, 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 until you get an Assyrian monolith talking about fighting a king named Ahab, who is the king of Israel. And then it's getting hard to deny that. Okay? This is the Mesha Stele. If you thought there was just one and I'm crazy, you were incorrect. This is piles. And they're everywhere. Every time they put a pick in the ground, they prove the Bible. It's literally insane. Like, they're like, I'm going to hike over there, and I've got my big pick with me, and I can't wait to find something that just proves the Bible. Is this a ring of David? What? Come on, man. Like, every single time they do that. It's from 840. Now, this is interesting because it also proves something biblical that isn't really specifically about us. This is the Mesha Stele is from King Mesha of Moab. This is actually the evidence. You see the language? It's sounds weird. Looks a little bit different from the other one. That's the Moabite language. So the Moabites that are discussed so often in the Bible were also thought to not really be real, possibly. Maybe it was a biblical name for something else. They're not even people of God. They're not even Israel. They're just an enemy. But this proves that this one's in the Louvre. So you can go there. You can see the Mona Lisa. You can have yourself a croissant. And you can check this out. Discovered in the late 1860s. This is King Mesha of Moab. So this is proof of Moab. It's proof of their language, their culture, their kingdom. And this is the tale, which is actually of him rebelling. The reason, and normally if you had a kingdom that Israel fought and lost, like they lost, they wouldn't talk about it. But this is a bragging stone for King Mesha of Moab, where he rebels against Israel and wins. Okay? There it is. 2 Kings 3, 4 to 7. I mean, look. Okay, just look at that. And I'll read it. 2 Kings 3, 4 to 7. Check it. Now Mesha, king of Moab, was a sheep breeder. He regularly paid king of Israel 100,000 lambs and the wool of 100,000 rams. But it happened when Ahab died that the king of Moab rebelled against the king of Israel. So King Joram went out to Samaria at the time and mustered all of Israel. And they went out saying, King Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, saying, the king of Moab has rebelled against me. Will you go with me to fight against Moab? And the basic end of the story is Moab is going to win. They rebel. So Mesha is going to write about his rebellion in his own stuff. Now this says Mesha's name, king of Moab. And this says Mesha's name, king of Moab. That, I don't know what you're supposed to do with that. If you're like atheist historian mad about the Bible, I don't know what you're supposed to do with that, because it's letter for letter perfect. It's actually even cooler than that. There's a whole long background. But he's called like the king of sheep, or like he's called the sheep, like master. And he's called that here. And in the Bible, you're like, well, that's a weird title for a king. Why would it be the sheep master? You're not going to believe me if I tell you, but maybe you will. You remember when Abraham and Lot had to split up? Because their herds were so big that they couldn't exist together without destroying the land. So they had to split up and went two different directions. One of them went over on one side. Remember those giant herds? That's Moab. He took over. This happened from the caves with Lot and his daughters. It's a long story. Another class for some other time. But that's how he got all the sheep. That's why there's so many. That's why he was able to pay those guys and needed to pay those guys all those sheep. Lots and lots of 100,000, lots and lots of sheep. So he was the king of the sheep for a biblical reason, and in his stele, and in the Bible. And he rebels, and like, woohoo, and they're immediately reconquered or whatever. But he made it out for a second. This is the Tel Dan stele. A tel is what we call a place where there used to be a city or something. And the archaeologist, I mentioned this last time, the archaeologist will see a mound because things have been built on top of other things. And it'll be built up in such a way that an archaeologist can recognize it. And he or she will say, that's a tell. There's something in there. It's not a hill. They can tell the difference. They can tell the difference. Anyway, tell is this thing. This one is called Dan. And in the Tel Dan, they begin to extract a whole bunch of stuff concerning King Hazael of Aram Damascus. Now we're going to get to Hazael in a second. Discovered in the 90s. So we're talking about, I got stuff from 2019 and 2020 at the end of this. So we got stuff being discovered all the time. But this is from the 90s. It's in Israel. And of course, they were really happy to have it, because this is what it says. One of the newest discoveries, one of the last giant discoveries of the 20th century. This stone refers to Ahaz, Jehoram, Israel, and Ben-Hadad, all names in the Bible. And this line right here literally says House of David. This is not only the first reference to Israel, because that was the one in Meneptah. This is the first reference specifically to David. And you can go look at the history here, but let's just look at Haziel for a second, because this dude is a big deal. You're going to see him a lot in the Bible, multiple times in multiple books. We deal with a guy named Haziel. Multiple times in multiple books. He's confirmed by not only his kingdom and the Bible and the Assyrians, but everyone else they came in contact with, because he's such a big deal, he's confirmed. But we are talking about triple confirmation tonight when it comes to the Assyrians, the Bible, and the records of Aram Damascus. So this is King Haziel. You'll notice all the biblical references and all the check marks. This is the tracking with archaeology matching the Bible. So in 2 Kings 5, you've got Naaman, the army general of Ben-Hadad II, being healed of leprosy by Elijah. And records of Naaman, the general of Ben-Hadad, in the other two records. So historically, you're going, okay, that's cool. There's a general. But what are you going to do about the whole healed of leprosy thing? Because he keeps fighting after that, because he's been healed of leprosy in the records of people that don't believe. What are you going to do about that? Elijah anoints Haziel. This is a whole up and down thing, because they're trying to be involved with him fighting against others. They're trying to get allies. It's a long story. You can read it in 1 and 2 Kings. He murders Ben-Hadad. Okay, he's killed Joram, king of Israel. 2 Chronicles 22, 5 to 7. It says Haziel, king of Arab Damascus, kills Joram, right? He created this king. That's a statue of him. Dozens of references from three different countries. And that is his stele, which says House of David. Here's specifically what it says. So this is King of Aram from 841 to 800. It's the victory stele of Haziel from 841. I killed Joram, son of Ahab, and Ahaziah, son of Jehoram, of the house of David. 2 Kings 8:28. House of David. So this is real specific. And it can be kind of weird and boring. Yes. Right, yeah. They're not digging in the streets of Jerusalem, right. Yeah, they'll be in different places. And this is actually his. So this is in Israel, but it's been dug up elsewhere. So he did kill Ben-Hadad after he was anointed by Elijah. And that's in 2 Kings 8. The annals of Shalmaneser said he usurped the throne and was a son of nobody. Shalmaneser in Assyria talks about Haziel and calls him the son of nobody, because the way he took the throne and he wasn't the son of kings. Elijah cried because he knew Haziel would kill Joram and Jehoshaphat. 2 Kings 8:28. So all of those references, there's eight different kings in these stories. All of those kings are cross-referenced in Assyria, Aram Damascus, and Israel in the Bible. So this is really specific, but this level of information is not random. It becomes impossible to doubt the historical accuracy of the Bible when you do stuff like this. We got pictures of these guys. Look at 2 Kings 13:5. King Joash, King Adad-nirari III, King Ben-Hadad III. Yahweh gave Israel the liver, they escaped Aram, 2 Kings 13:5. Israel is King Joash, the deliverer is King Adad-nirari III, and they escaped Aram, which is King Ben-Hadad III. So, Israel had suffered long and hard under Hazael and his son Ben-Hadad III, and we finally get this great specific textual archaeological cross reference. The rim of Joash, one of our last delay for tonight, if you probably still laid out, because that's a lot. But I just want to make sure you understand that we're not talking about some weird second class reference somewhere. We're talking about a landslide of archaeological scientific evidence that cannot be denied by any scientist from anywhere. The Rim Adullam delay is the conquest delay of Adad-nirari II of Assyria. He is getting tribute from Joash of Samaria. Samaria is the capital of Israel. There's a whole story about why they're Samaritans. That's another class. But he defeats Ben-Hadad and gets tribute from Joash because Adad-nirari of Assyria defeats Ben-Hadad and helps. So Joash, Israel, is sending him tribute. This is more evidence. I don't know what to say. Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. Oh, because their archaeologists have recovered it and brought it there. Yeah, they've recovered it in Aram Damascus and brought it there. So it's really complicated how all the archaeological stuff gets handled. In some cases, it stays where it was found. But most of the time, the people who discover it get claim to it. Sometimes you give stuff back to Israel because it's so important. And this one's obviously the most ancient, most important thing that mentions House of David. Israel has to have that. But if you discover things, sometimes you give them back. Sometimes they're in a museum. So that statue we talked about last time that we think might be Moses is in Liverpool. Depending on where it gets donated or who pays for the expedition, all those things, get cross-referenced. So, pausing right there for a moment, that is the story of all the stelae and all the different archaeological evidence from all these different countries that all cross-reference, specifically mentioning names in the Bible and things like House of David and Israel. What that does is give us undisputed scientific, archaeological, and historical evidence of the reality of the kingdom of Israel. David was real. Solomon was real. The kingdom of Israel was real. Once we get solid on that, then we have our dates. They all cross-reference and match. So another important thing about this is how all the dates match. This king's fighting Solomon. He's talking about fighting Solomon on this date. That's within our understanding of when Solomon ruled. Right, this guy's attacking David, talking about David on this point. This guy's talking about Israel, but not the house of David because it's in the time of Judges before David is alive. All these things are lining up historically and archaeologically, but also chronologically. So that means we can nail down the date of Solomon building the temple, which means we can nail down the date of the Exodus. So that's why all of these things are interwoven. So let's get some more new, exciting stuff. I'm going to talk to you about the Philistines for a minute. Now, this is important because everybody that was raised in the church, everybody that went to Sunday school, everybody that heard stories about all these things knew the Philistines. Goliath's a Philistine, and Samson's hair gets cut and he's being abused by the Philistines. And they tie him between the pillars and his hair's growing out. And all this stuff we studied, all the bad guys in the time of Judges and in David, it's the Philistines. And we always heard all the stories about the Philistines. The problem was there was no actual evidence of any Philistines. People just believed it because there's not, we haven't found the ark. We don't know for sure, so we have to believe. But every time that we start looking for something, you get your face blown off. And the Philistines were always this big question mark. For biblical historians and for archaeologists, they're like, okay, I don't understand. There's all these stories. I'm an archaeologist. Let's say I'm a secular archaeologist. I believe that David and Solomon are real. I've got evidence of that. I've read these stele and I'm good. All these stories about the Philistines are probably real, but we don't have any evidence of the Philistines. Who could they be? And that, just a few years ago, is when that started getting solved. They started pulling out stuff and putting it together. And the way I'm going to end tonight with some new discoveries is just going to be like, so let's go. Until recently, there's only evidence in the Bible and nothing else. They started working on the word. So linguists are going to come together with historians, archaeologists. So Hebrew linguists, Hebrew historians, archaeologists, secular historians, anthropologists, are all going to start working on trying to figure this out over the last 40 or 50 years. And the linguists are going to realize that there is this word that's mentioned in other places, but linguistically it looks like two different versions of the same word. And this is a clue. The Palestine. This is a clue. Once they get the first clue, they're following the breadcrumbs, trying to figure it out, okay? So this is the base word for Palestine. You guys know what Palestine is. It's that area of the world. It's a parallel to an Assyrian term, Palestine, which was cross-referenced. Bear with me, I know this is crazy. But the Assyrian term Palestine, which is related to Palestine, is cross-referenced with the Egyptian term Palestine. That makes sense, I hope. Linguistically, it's crazy, but there it is. Okay. Once we discover the Peliset spoken of in Egypt are the Philistines, then we're really on track. Now, how would we discover that? Well, first of all, there's the linguistics. Second of all, there's the timing. So this chronology, this timing we've been talking about is of utmost importance. Because you know the dates of the Philistines. You know when they did stuff in the Bible. If you look in the secular archaeological record and you find Peliset doing the same things at the same time, ta-da. It's not hard to understand. People have different words in different languages for different things, but these are all really, really close. So this was the big discovery. So these people are talked about as sea people in both the Bible and Egypt. So their nickname, the sea people, and their time frame, 1200-ish BC, and the words themselves have all now been cross-referenced so that we have access to trying to figure out who the Philistines were. So now, this is from the mortuary temple of Ramses III in Luxor. Okay. Ramses III fought the Philistines around 1180 BC. They're coming to the area around 1200, give or take BC. And they're fighting. Remember, 1180 is after 1200, okay, 20 years later. They're fighting Ramses II, Ramses III. And they're glad they didn't fight Ramses II. Ramses III, and he beats them, and takes them prisoner. So when we have Ramses III's carving of the Pellicet prisoners, we have the next clue. So we got the linguistics, we got the locations, we got the names, we got the timing. Now, these guys are wearing a little something different on their head. They look a certain way. If that's cultural, we can track it. And we can track it. Same guys. We've got the same headset. You with me? You with me? Same guys. Mentioned the illustrations of the battle. These are Philistines, and they're fighting. First of all, we need to pay attention to everything. First of all, where are they fighting? On the water. Sea people. Let's look at their armor, their weapons. Look at the armor. Seems to be a crosshatch of bronze. Seems to be heavy. Right? Look at their big shield. Look at the weapons they're using. What is this weapon? It's a long spear, you see. Right? Okay. There's another one. Here they're fighting some chariots. Look. Same guys, look. Look at their big spears. Okay? We're tracking them now. We got the time frame. We got how they look, what they wear, what they fight with. We've got the time, the location, the organization. So they've got their chariots. But look what you've got in this picture. This is Medinet Habu. This is a big complex, temple complex in Egypt. Look what you got. Giant shields, those helmets. But they don't have bows and arrows. Most people using chariots in the ancient world used bows and arrows from chariots. They're using spears, giant heavy spears. You see it? Okay. It's weird. They've got javelins. They've got giant shields. And yet another temple relief. You can see they're wearing what archaeologists and anthropologists have called lobster armor. They're doing that because it's sea people. But you see his headdress. You see his armor. You see how he's been beat down by the Egyptian guy. You see how you can tell the difference? The Egyptian headdress and his headdress. You see his armor that's sketched by an archaeologist, anthropologist, of the armor they keep seeing. So they keep seeing this big heavy armor, metal, these giant shields, these crazy spears, right? Here he is. More giant spears, more headdresses. It's another example, large swords. Big heavy sword, large shields, javelins. They got javelins and spears. This is them mercilessly slaughtering some Egyptian mercenaries. Also in relief in Medinet Habu. Okay? So there it is. There's an artist rendering from the anthropologist. There's a picture from the wall. Philistine helmet. Bronze and leathery strips. Very distinctive. It allows this tracking to happen. Now let me explain what that is. Think about it. First of all, you've got a metal band protecting you from getting hit in the head. Okay? You've got a chin strap holding it on your head. Then you've got these leather strips that are lined up so it looks impressive, but it's like a spring of leather. So if you go to hit them in the head, it protects their head and kind of bounces. It makes them look bigger, kind of like the whole Japanese armor with the big things on the helmet. Makes them look bigger, makes them look crazier. Protects their head. But this is a complex, very unique to the culture design. We have dozens of pieces of evidence now of these Philistines. Okay? Now, here's the most important thing for you as a biblical scholar to get from the helmet. If I went back to everyone else's helmet, you would see closed eyes. Think about the Spartan helmet. Everybody's like, well, why didn't David pick up a big sword and go sword fight? I'm like, does David look like a sword fighter? He brought sandwiches. Okay? He needs God. And he needs what he's good at. What he's good at is a sling and a stone. And he whacks that guy right between the eyes at Mach 6 with that freaking stone. And he goes down. And what does David do? Go over, pick his own giant crazy sword up, and cut his head off. Right? Look at this. Look at the spears, the swords, the javelins, the armor. Look at it. Now, this is the coolest part. That's 1200 when the Philistines arrive. Those are the dates, right? The Bronze Age and the Iron Age. The Bronze Age, everybody's using bronze armor and weapons. The Iron Age, people are making steel. They're using steel weapons. There's a change over time. If this was all true, then what we would have is a description that matches that in the Bible. And if it got really crazy, the guy involved that was a Philistine would be mixing bronze and steel. He wouldn't have just bronze weapons or just steel weapons. They're bridging the gap between the bronze and steel and Iron Age. You see? All right. Here is the archaeology. A bronze javelin found at the site of the Philistines. Now, we're excavating because now we've discovered the time frame of the Philistines. We've discovered the locations and we've cross-referenced it. So now that gives the secular archaeologist the evidence and money that he gets to get the money to go do the dig. You can't go walk into Yale and say, hey, I need a couple hundred thousand to go dig in Ashkelon because the Bible, they're not going to believe you. If you say, hey, here's the palace, here's the headgear, here's what we got, they'll give you the money and you can go dig. They finally started doing that just a couple years ago, not long ago. And when they start digging at the right time, in the right location, in the places that were the five main cities of the Philistines, they begin digging stuff up. And this is the first thing I want to show you. Bronze javelins at the Philistine site. There they are. Large iron spearhead that found at Abydos. There it is. You can hold it. They're not, I mean, with gloves, okay? A collection of bronze and iron weapons at Tel Esa. This is a collection of bronze and iron weapons, proving the dates, proving the crossing over between Bronze and Iron Age. Now, if we only had a match in the Bible, everybody could shut up and stop trying to argue against the Bible. Here we go. They didn't use bows and arrows, which is weird. They used javelins, large spears, and large swords. They protected themselves with very heavy shields. They had decorative bronze helmets that had no forehead protection. And they used a lot of helpers and assistants, which worked with them on the battlefield because everything was so big and heavy. Okay? So once and for all, here it is. 1 Samuel 17, 4 through 7. And a champion went out from the camp of the Philistines named Goliath from Gath. We're digging in Gath right now. It's a real town. It's called Tel Assos. They found the tell. They're digging up Gath right now. His height was 6 cubits in a span. Really big guy. He had a bronze helmet on his head. And he was armed with a coat of mail, a heavy metal coat. The weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze. It's a giant, heavy bronze coat, just like the lobster armor. He had bronze armor on his legs, a bronze javelin between his shoulders. The staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam. In other words, it's a giant spear with an iron spearhead that weighed 600 shekels. And he had a shield bearer that went with him with his giant shield. It's like a photograph of the people at the time carving on the walls. Every detail. I read that when I was a kid. He just looks like a big tank guy, super scary. Dave's like, right? I thought it was cool as a kid. But that's not what it is. It's exact. Bronze helmet, bronze armor, bronze tablet, iron spearhead, which we have found. Everything matches. I mean, I don't know what to say about it because it's so exact and perfect. You'd have to be like, I don't know, like a crazy person to deny it. But people still do. I mean, they still do. But so every single word of this passage in 1 Samuel is absolutely confirmed by archaeology and history. There's just no other way around it. Now, since I finished this, and I got this last slide for you, if you want to go to modernpaladin.com or .org, I mean, you can see a lot more videos and stuff. You can read a lot more stuff. You can email me if you have any questions. I got a couple of the little things from the first class still if you want one of those. But let me add the new stuff. Every time something happens, it will just literally blow your mind. So now they know. Now they know Philistines are real. Gath is a real place. Ashdod is a real place. In Ashdod, they dug up a whole village, a whole section, and they found a Philistine graveyard, okay? And in the Philistine graveyard, they've got 200 graves. Now, you can look this up. It's Ashkelon, A-S-H-K-E-L-O-N, Ashkelon. It was on that map in the beginning. There's five great cities, Gath and Ashkelon, et cetera. There's five great cities. So Ashkelon is on the coast. They're digging it up. They find 200 burial sites. That's where that, a lot of that stuff is coming from, but it's coming from multiple places. Then they found some odd things about Philistine culture. One of the things they did, and this is kind of weird, but they found a couple babies, like young kids that had died, and what they did is they buried them in the house. Now, normally they have burials in a cemetery type situation. But if they had a small child that died, they would bury it in the house under the floor. It's kind of weird, but that's what they did. So they were pulling all that up with a jar of perfume, by the way. So I think that was probably this the smell. But anyway, is that Timmy? Anyway, the point is, sorry. The point is that when they had some of these burials inside these houses, what it meant was they got covered with more stuff and then covered with more stuff. And that meant that they were more protected. So they found a few, and believe it or not, they've managed to pull DNA from some of these sites. Now, this is brand new. It's like 2019. This is brand new. Now, they've been, thank goodness, there's a thing called paleogeneticists. Okay, they would be very useful in Jurassic Park. But what they do is they analyze and organize DNA from ancient sites, like from the bones. Now, most places you can't do that because it's so desiccated, so dry and old, you can't recover any DNA. But because the sites are getting to be more and more and more, they've recovered some DNA. Now, this is important because the Bible is very clear, and you can look it up. There's about 40 major passages about Philip and about Philistines. They came from the islands of the Mediterranean, okay? And they make it very clear. They use the word, in ancient Hebrew, they use the word for Crete. So they come from islands in the Mediterranean. Why does that matter? Well, if the Bible was going to be defeated, this would be an easy one. Because probably when you dig up people in the Middle East, the genetics are going to be from the people in the Middle East. It's going to be Egyptian DNA, or it's going to be Canaanite DNA. Oh, this is the Canaanite site. Totally normal archaeologically. We're digging the site in ancient Canaan. We get Canaanites. That makes sense. This was a great moment to take out the Bible. But all the DNA is from the islands of the Mediterranean. They've literally got paleo, ancient world, DNA scientists showing, without even thinking about the Bible, that these guys are from the islands. They're from probably Sardinia, possibly Sicily and Crete. Once again, absolute confirmation. All they had to do was say those guys are from the East, and we would have problems because none of that stuff would matter. But once again, there it is. It keeps going on like that over and over and over. And that's brand new. Every time they stick a pick in the ground, it's proven in the Bible. It's mind-boggling. So that was one of the newest things that happened involving the recovery of DNA from the Ashkelon site and the analysis finally coming in just over the last couple of years that these were weird. It's weird. They were like sea people. So it's going to keep mounting all the time. I was talking, when I was in archaeology classes at Oxford, I was the only believer in the classes usually. And one of my classes had a lady that was not only a PhD, but she was an actual member of the royal family. And you cannot tell that kind of person anything. So we were having this discussion. And she's like, well, I guess I'm going to wait till they dig up a giant. And I'm like, well, just wait. Because you keep digging in these places, something crazy is going to happen. So I'm going to end with the newest crazy. You're going to have to look it up because you're not going to believe me. But here it is. Remember Gath, the home of Goliath? They've been digging up Gath just the last few years. It's a brand new. They're digging up Gath. Listen to me. One last minute and I'll leave you alone for a year. They're baffled because the houses are too big. They're twice as wide and multiple times taller than they're supposed to be. The population of the city has other cities nearby of the same time period with the same population. So they're not just grabbing at straws in the dark. They know the size the city is supposed to be. How many people are in it, what size it is, how the city blocks are laid out. They know all of that. They have other cities all around it to compare it to. They have endless drawings of the excavations of those cities. They're digging the city up, and the first comment is, the city blocks are twice as long as they're supposed to be. What is going on? Why are the blocks? Because they're using the same houses, the same structures. Why are they so big? And they can't figure it out, of course. Why on earth would houses in Gath have big, big doors? I mean, it's almost like giant people live there. It's crazy. I wish I was making that up. I wish I was just a crazy person. Because it'd be a whole lot easier to have discussions with other intellectual people at academic environments if I wasn't the guy that knows the doors are 9 feet tall in Gath. It would be much better if I did not know that information. Like, wasn't it still culture? Like, they all wore stilts. Maybe they were like circus performers and everybody had stilts. We need to look for the stilts. That's what the atheist archaeologist is doing right now. He's like, look for stilts. Just find me something that looks like stilts because we're not getting through this one. Sooner or later, they're going to dig up a giant crazy dude. And they're going to be like, we surrender. Where's the nearest church? Man, I tried so hard. But that's true. Right now, they're as we speak, they're sitting in Gath with a full team, and they're digging up giant houses and huge city blocks. It's much bigger than it's supposed to be, much taller. It's four times taller because they're like, why is it four times taller? One floor for one person, double the person's size, double the floors, two-floor building. Four times taller. It's just the same old two-floor building that they have all over the area. But for some reason, they're twice as tall. That's true. Go look it up. So anyway, they're going to keep digging. Sooner or later, they're going to find a femur like this, and the guy's going to be like, can we hide it? No, because the photographers already took pictures of it. There's this thing called the internet now. It's like, come on, man. Come on. All right, questions? Yes, so randomly in the archaeological record, there's this random giant people. So, like, for instance, if you go look up the stelae of Sargon, you'll notice that Sargon is fighting, and everybody he's fighting is very small. And then he has spears sticking around him, and they're all like little sticks to him. Now, the secular archaeological explanation for that is that he's depicted as gigantic because he's a big man. In the archaeology, in the history of the Mesopotamia region, they refer to these kings, some of them, but not all of them, as like the big man. This is where we get like big man on campus, or that guy's a big guy. And so people are saying, oh, well, that's a reference to their position. They're the big guy, right? Here's a picture of the guy twice as tall as a normal person. But that's because he's portrayed large because he's a king. Here's a description of him as an extra big guy, but that's because he's a king. Obviously, that is an argument to be had. But randomly, there seem to be very large people. Now, biblically, this would be a remnant of the people pre-Noah. Whether they came through one of Noah's sons' wives, because we don't know their background, or whether they could tread water really well, or maybe they were sea people and had boats. But for some reason, there were some survivors of the giant people, the Nephilim. We know that because that's what Saul and David were tasked to do to get rid of the last of that remnant of darkness in the earth. That's a very long class for much later. But that Nephilim pre-flood connection is why that genetics continues in some way. And there's these people that are just big. We don't know how big. I'm not trying to say they're 45 feet tall. Okay, it's not crazy. But they're gigantic. They're big. Maybe they're 9 feet tall. Now, we've got guys, I don't know how tall that the Chinese basketball guy is. He's like 8 feet tall almost. I mean, that's not that hard to understand. It could exist. And somebody like Goliath and his family, remember he's described as a giant, and his brothers. So it's a whole bunch of guys, maybe just the leaders and maybe just that town. So it's kind of random, but evidently all you need is a little rock. So
it's good.
Yes, sir. Right. So this is the one of the spookiest, weirdest parts of the Bible. It's very short, very strange, and infinitely long in discussion terms. But it looks like before the flood, everything was really bad. That's why you needed a flood. It was so bad because some renegade angels, basically, had come and mated with human women. And the offspring were giants and, you know, Hercules, Medusa type things. I'm convinced, theoretically, historically, and mythologically, that some of those mythologies are cross-referencing with some of the pre-flood. So, for instance, you start talking about Hercules or Medusa or whatever it is. The reason I believe that personally from my studies is that the story of Gilgamesh, he's a hero from Mesopotamia. He's described as having a human mother, and his father is some kind of angelic being. But he goes in the mythology of Gilgamesh in Mesopotamia and visits a guy who built a big boat in a flood and saved his family. That's in the legends of Gilgamesh in Sumerian mythology, the flood and Noah. So that's crazy right there. We're way out on the edge, okay? But that cross-references, and that's how that would be possible. And that's why they might dig up Gath and find giant doors on big houses. And it's crazy because all the secular scientists are like, what do we do with this? I don't know. Maybe read the Bible. I don't know what to tell you because it's crazy. It is. But there it is. They're digging it up right now. I'll have pictures. Next time I do this, I'll probably have pictures and drawings of the houses. I might have even been to one by the time we do this again. Question? Yes, sir. Yeah, I think that a lot of the Philistines were probably normal. You know, I think a lot of them probably looked like normal people. But I know that some of them, like Goliath and his family, were big. And the other towns in the five main cities of the Philistines have not reflected what's happening in Gath. My best intellectual academic theory is that the reason they're so specific in the Bible about Goliath and Gath, and now he's a guy from Gath, and these are the people from Gath, is that Gath's got the crazy. Gath's got some of the big guys. And they're Goliath's family, plus maybe other families. But they don't need a whole bunch of them on the battlefield. Goliath can walk out there like, what's up? And the whole entire Israel army is frozen in fear. They're shaking in their armor. Nobody's moving. Except for the lunch boy. He's like, I'm going to put my heart down for a second. I was writing this love poem for this girl, but I'm going to put that over here and go take this dude out. Get up, buddy. Right? I don't know. David was, I don't know. I don't know how to describe David, but he wasn't impressive. Because when they went to his house looking for soldiers, they hid him. He's like the weird, scrawny kid. They're like, he's way too small. He sings well, you know, but he's way too small. He can't fight anybody. Let his brothers go fight. But God loves to do that. God loves to take this totally random person that makes no sense and just lift them up, and suddenly they're doing all this stuff to help all these people. He builds off of your shortcomings, off of your problems and your issues. He'll take something negative and build it. Like, oh, you thought that alcoholism was a bad thing. It was, sure, what you did in that ditch, that was bad, but now you're running the prison ministry for AA, and 4,700 guys have been saved in the last 20 years, you know. So it worked out. And why were those 2,000 guys saved in the prison ministry? Because they could trust that guy. They could hear him. Why could they hear him? Because he was one of them, because he'd been where they were. God used that negativity, that suffering, to grow greatness. That's what he did with David. David was jacked up. Peeping Tom, goofball. David was jacked up. But every single piece of it got used for greatness. All right. This is 8. Any other questions? Thank you guys so much for coming out for these 3 classes. It was a blast. And there's more stuff online. If you go to modernpaladin.org, you'll see plenty of stuff. If you have any additional questions or follow-up questions, just email me and I'll answer it right away. Otherwise, I'll be here every weekend pretty much. So come see me. Thanks. Thank you.